On Monday, August 8th, Tall Can Audio hits 1,000 episodes.
Wait, that's still on? Who could possibly still care?
And the gang is all here to celebrate.
It's euphoric. It's got to be close to nirvana. It's outstanding.
For the first time ever, Maddie, Michaela, Rob, and Matt are all live in studio together.
It's happening, you guys. It's happening. Oh, my God, guys. Oh, my God. I wish you all were here.
Is this likely to go well?
Just check my notes here. No.
At least it will make a lot of noise.
Boom. Here comes the boom.
1,000 pods and 1,000 pints.
I don't think I've ever been as proud in my entire life.
TCA 1000 drops Monday, August 8th, wherever you find low-quality podcasts.
Fuck, it's out of control. Shit.
I just realized that I picked probably, in terms of the alcohol content, some of the more potent ones.
Hey! Aren't you that guy everybody hates?
No, man, no.
This is Tall Can Audio. Follow along on Twitter at Tall Can Audio or at facebook.com/tallcanaudio.
Just do it!
How's it going, everybody? Welcome into an all-new episode of the Tall Can Audio podcast. Matt Robinson here with you. In our studios in beautiful Bytown, Canada. We're on Twitter and Instagram at Tall Can Audio, facebook.com/tallcanaudio, and I hope you'll hit subscribe wherever you're listening right now. Really happy to be welcoming to the show today, Graham Nichols. You may know him better as the sixth, I've been tripping over this for a while now as I've been promoting that you were coming on, the sixth Sens. You know him from Sens Twitter. Graham Nichols is here. How are you doing tonight?
Hey, Matt, thanks for having me on. Really enjoyed you being here. Looking forward to it.
Well, don't speak too soon. We'll see, right?
there's still time.
Yeah, exactly. So reached out to Graham a week or so ago and asked if he was willing to come on, and it was really cool. He was willing to do so, and so I kind of told him what we do here and that we had to have a couple beers while we chatted, and it was Graham that suggested the Dominion City Brewing Company here in Ottawa. Why was that a go-to this time for you?
I just saw on social media, I follow them on Instagram, so I just saw that they had a number of new small batches that they've been putting out. So I just figured this would be an awesome opportunity to try some of these new beers and enjoy them with you.
Well, I'm a follower of, I have a different beer every show when we do one of these, and so when you said Dominion City, I was like, all right, I'm going to do that too. And then somehow I ended up out in front of you, bought a whole bunch of different stuff that'll carry me through a few different shows. What have you chosen for tonight's discussion?
So they're small cans. They're only 355 mils. But
I was caught off guard by that.
I just realized that I picked probably, in terms of the alcohol content, some of the more potent ones.
Awesome.
That's no trouble, right, with a lot of these craft beers.
Yep.
If you're used to like 4 or 5%, now you're looking at like I just grabbed a Imperial Stout with pistachio.
Okay,
small.
So that's I think a 10%.
Yeah.
So I bought a few of those too.
So maybe I'll save that for the end.
Yeah, that's a good call. I grabbed a couple of those too, but I didn't bring them in for tonight's show. I got the other stout in my hand here, the Times Arrow Stout, it's called, and it's down. It's more a standard 4.7, and I've also got the Civic Pilsner that I'll get to, I think, after this stout I'm going to try. So you sounded like maybe you brought more than one in.
I just have the two with me right now. I have the Monster Mash Double IPA.
Okay.
And that is 8%. So it's a small step down from the Imperial Stout, but it's still punching its weight.
We'll save the really tough questions for Graham to the end by the sound of this one.
yeah, should be interesting.
Well, let's fire it up. Are you normally? Yes. Oh, yours is a way more solid crack than mine was over here. Are you normally a craft beer guy, or are you kind of in and out? What's your background there, or your story there?
Yeah, I just love craft beer. Doesn't matter where. I'm fortunate to live in the West End, and there's just so many different breweries.
Yes.
Around, even in like the Ottawa Valley, like I don't have any problems driving to Whitewater to go see their facility. If anyone hasn't been, once this pandemic dies down a little bit and they reopen and allow people in for food and stuff, it's a really cool spot. The food's fantastic. The beer is really good. Whitewater's a good favorite of mine. I love Calabogie stuff. I like their the little brewer that they have off Schneider Road in Kanata, Kanata North. Yeah, it's really nice. And Ridge Rock and Carp, where I grew up.
I've been heavy into the
really
Ridge
good
Rock
stuff as well. Calvin DeHaan, NHLer.
Yeah,
he's one of the co-owners there. And yeah, they just put out great stuff. And it's, you know, I just love supporting local. I you know, it's just one of those things. And yeah, it's there's so many options in Ottawa. It's awesome.
Well, I grew up in Oshawa, so I'm also a Calvin DeHaan fan, former captain of the Oshawa Generals before I moved up here. So I've been into the Ridge Rock quite a bit through the pandemic as well. Whitewater has like a really thick, like it's like chocolate peanut butter milkshake stout or something like that that I tried a couple years ago that I just loved. And I don't know that it was a regular option. Maybe it was just a seasonal or something, but for a while there, I couldn't get enough of that one. But I'm like you, I'm kind of out here towards the West End in Nepean anyway, but through the pandemic with everybody delivering, like, yeah, getting as much into the studio here as I can for future shows and whatever else. How did you get into the craft beer thing? Were you, like, you're right, the Ottawa scene kind of exploded here over the last couple of years. How do you find your way into it? Were you always a wanting to try new stuff, or in college were you more just like a Budweiser Canadian kind of guy, or how does that go?
Yeah, I think in university it was like drink the cheapest stuff you can, because money wasn't the easiest thing to come by. But it's a good question, and to be honest with you, I can't even really remember. I guess, you know, being West End, I think you could go to like the Cheshire Cat, which usually had, you know, like a great selection of beers and stuff that was kind of like a little bit off the radar at the time. And that was kind of like, I don't know if that was the launching pad that threw me down this path, but yeah, it's just the flavors have been really good, and the beers have been different, and maybe that was part of it, just try new stuff and venture out there.
It makes me feel a little less guilty about my alcoholism, right? Like now it's also a hobby now.
No,
right?
It's like, true. And like you mentioned the delivery services earlier, and I think that was a huge driving force behind like buying more craft beer during the pandemic, right? Like you wanted to support local, and you want to support your local businesses and restaurants and everything else, and craft beer was no different. And the delivery services that a lot of these companies provided was a blessing and it was a curse, right?
Yeah, for sure it was. I can tell you I'm at a different belt loop than I was at the beginning of the pandemic. So, you know, I don't think I'm the only one. So, yeah, what was your first impression of the one you've cracked open there?
It's good. It's sweet. So it's not very, it's a double IPA, but it's not like super, super hoppy. So it almost tastes like milder Sunsplit, maybe.
Right, okay.
Less citrusy, but still sweet.
The one I got over here is almost like a, and it didn't list this in the description or on the can, but it's almost got like a smoked feel to it, which I really like. And there's something hanging around in the aftertaste of it that I'm not quite able to put my finger on yet, but I am enjoying it, and I guess it's a good thing I'm going to be steering the ship here for a little while at 4.7 versus your 8 and 10. So we'll see how this goes as we make our way through. Graham has written for The Athletic. He's got a blog. He's well known on Sen's Twitter. He's got a podcast now. I want to get to a bunch of that, but tell me kind of where the Sixth Sen's persona comes from first. How do you kind of get started in the world of online Sen's fandom?
I think it all started in university. Like, you know, you'd read the traditional news types of that era, and there was a lot of stuff in the Citizen and Sun at the time. I think they each had about like three reporters each who would cover the team. And, you know, like with any traditional media, you read a lot of stuff, and it's just a lot of reporting on what's happening without a ton of insight or analysis. And then,
sure.
You know, for the people putting out their own opinions and stuff, it was just stuff that I didn't necessarily agree with. And I'm like, well, in my head, and you know, I was young and didn't know any better at the time. And it was more of a, well, not everybody can think like this or you know, believe what is being written. So maybe there's an opportunity to voice something different. So I started doing that just as a hobby. And it just kind of ramped up. I think it started, was it 2008? I can't even remember now.
Wow, so but it was a while ago. Pre-Twitter.
Pardon?
Pre-Twitter.
Pre-Twitter, yeah. So it's been going on for a while, but, you know, I think when I started out, it was more about knocking down the opinions of people who were already, you know, established. And it was just, you know, I think there was a little bit of immaturity and trying to be irreverent and funny. And, you know, I didn't have like my own voice at the time that was strong enough. Like, I just didn't have confidence in my own voice and putting my own stuff out there. So instead of doing that, I would kind of like just tear into the opinions of others sometimes. and it kind of caught on, like, and you know, it was just like the young, immature, dumb thing to do. And it was just, it was a bit juvenile at times. And, you know, as I think, as I kept going, my voice, I got more confident in what I had to say. And I stopped doing that because, you know, I thought my opinion could stand on its own. And
sure.
And, you know, I've met some guys at since starting, and, you know, you apologize and yeah, everybody's been really nice. I've had no issues since, but it just writing the blog has given me an opportunity to do a lot of cool things in hockey. And it's been great. I've met a lot of cool people and experienced a lot of cool things. So I can't complain about what I've done. It started as a hobby. It's still a hobby, but it's a passion of mine, and I just enjoy doing it. And the fact that, you know, people read my stuff and enjoy it and maybe take something from it, it's really cool and humbling.
I think that's relatable because around here, you know, when the pod first started, you were sort of, in my head, rebelling against traditional mainstream radio. That's like, just say what you mean, just and like have these good conversations that aren't constantly being broken up with this segment is brought to you by Mazda and shit like that, right? And then you start to get an audience and then you start to be able to get some guests and you're like, oh, I think we ripped that guy. I'm pretty sure he didn't listen to episode 27 when only like 13 people were listening, but I feel a little strange now. So it does kind of, you grow into your own voice and like you say, you become less reliant on just countering what other people are saying. Is there a specific piece that you wrote or a moment that you can remember where either the number of readers got to a certain point or like a moment where you went like, oh, I'm making an impact here, or I feel like people actually want to read this now?
There was a piece that I wrote a long time ago. It was shortly after, like Brian Murray was kind of catching flack a little bit. Like it was after the Stanley Cup run, the team was kind of on the downslope, and you know, publicly you're seeing a lot of people be like, oh, well, Brian Murray's to blame. He's the general manager of this hockey team. And I think at the time I wrote like a lengthy piece of analysis that essentially broke down like John Mockler's draft record, his signings, his decisions, and just the whiffs, like the constant whiffs. And you know, I hope the piece put in perspective. It caught on with a few people, and it got some traction and some play because it was just different at the time. And, you know, like Brian Murray was an okay general manager. I don't think he was a good or a great one for the Ottawa Senators. I think he was just okay. He was average. And,
right.
But that was a marked step up from what John Mockler was doing. And John Mockler inherited a very strong Senators club, and he almost decimated it. And his draft record was terrible. And it was just a change. It was just, I think that there's a tendency whenever it comes to evaluating coaches, players, managers, general managers, whatever. There's a tendency to look at what you're doing now as opposed to the circumstances that you're given or, you know, the effects of the consequences of your decision aren't really going to be felt until years down the road. And I think with under Mockler, that's exactly what happened. Like he was making decisions 3, 4, 5 years ago that Brian Murray was paying for the price for down the road.
Right. Well, it's Brian Burke always says that Brian Murray built the Stanley Cup team in Anaheim that Burke got a ring for. Right. And as you said, you usually don't get to hang around long enough to, good or bad, right, be punished for the crap that you did or, you know, be recognized for the good stuff that you did if you don't do it fast enough. So I think that's an interesting point. What do you think of, as someone who's written for The Athletic, who, in my opinion, is really in this market, maybe the only completely detached publication covering the Senators? I mean, the radio station here has some, they need the Senators. Now, the Senators need them as well, and the same with some of the local newspaper writers and stuff, but you almost get a little too close. What do you think about the dynamic of the way this team is covered in what is a small market in the NHL? And do you find that it maybe gets a little too cozy sometimes, or is that maybe in the fans' head a little too much? Or what do you think of that dynamic?
I don't think it gets necessarily too cozy. I think if it comes to like criticizing things that the organization has done in recent years, you know, I think in print, on the radio, it's well known that, you know, people have voiced their concerns over how the owner's been running this hockey team. And the one thing that I will say is that people, even though they don't say it and they might not be transparent, they know a lot more information than they're letting on.
Yes. Yeah.
And it's kind of like it's a really delicate balancing act. Because if you watch the patterns on the news and you see that, you know, like the general manager hasn't spoken on the radio broadcast partner of the Ottawa Senators in months.
Yeah.
There's a very good reason for that. If he doesn't give an interview in a newspaper, there's a very good reason for that. And rather than dump on the broadcast partner or the newspapers or any traditional media outlet, it's not their fault. You know, they're trying. They want access to these players, but unfortunately, like you said, it's a one horse town. The Ottawa Senators are the only major professional sports team in this city,
right?
And they run it like that. And if they don't receive the favorable coverage that they think they deserve, you're not gonna have a lot of access to the Ottawa Senators.
Well, they've picked some strange fights, right? Like to call Ian Mendez Bush League. You're like, there's not a less Bush League guy in hockey media in this country, right? Like, there's been a really strange dynamic there. We had Ian in just after that happened, and he's like, I don't know what to do with that. I'm doing my best to do the job. I have to be fair to the team, but I also have to be honest with the listeners, right? It's a strange dynamic I do find with, you know, one sports station in the city and one team, and if they're not getting along, it's hard for the fan base to be able to get a real fair sense of what's happening.
No, and Ian's probably one of the most genuinely nice guys in this industry. And the leaps and bounds that guy goes to for people that just to help people that he doesn't have to, it's incredible. And, you know, like Haley Salvian came here, was here for Thanksgiving, and she didn't have Thanksgiving dinner. So what does Ian do? He takes his daughter and drops off Thanksgiving dinner at Haley's condo.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, does he have to do that? No, but that's not who Ian Mendez is. Ian Mendez is going to give Haley food on a holiday weekend. So he's just a genuinely nice guy who does his job really well. And if that rubs people the wrong way, then that's probably not on Ian. That's probably on
that's
the people.
Right.
That's probably on the people that he's somehow bothered.
So talk to me a little bit about how you end up writing for The Athletic and you know how that opportunity arises, but also I've spoken to a number of journalists who say that when you're writing for the mainstream, it sort of pulls the fandom out of you. And obviously when you got started, The Sixth Sense stems from you being a fan of the team. How does the opportunity come around, and how did you find that maybe writing for The Athletic changed your view of the team, if at all?
So I got my start essentially because I was doing freelance work for the Ottawa Citizen for a couple of years, writing for James Gordon, who had asked me to submit pieces from time to time, especially during the postseason when, you know, everybody's kind of got their eyes on the newspapers and stuff. So Tyler Dello, myself, Travis Yost were writing some stuff for The Citizen on analytics and delving into those topics. And when James Gordon got the opportunity to write and run the Ottawa Hub for The Athletic, he reached out to me, and he reached out to a few others as well. And I guess readership for my stuff was strong, and I've just kind of kept doing it. But you know, I'm furloughed right now, still right. Waiting to get back into it, which is fine. Like, this isn't my primary source of income, so I'm doing totally fine. But I miss writing. I miss writing for the big platform. And, you know, I think for the first little bit, like you said, you know, when you're writing on your own, you essentially want to cover like every facet that you can and hit on every topic that you can. But I think where I've struggled with The Athletic is that as a freelance guy, I'm not getting the media stuff. You know, the people who are full-time or national writers are going to get the stuff. So even if you submit a request to your editor, or the manager, you're probably not going to get the topic that you want to hit on. So you kind of have to look for crumbs where you can hit angles that others might not hit. And
right.
especially early on, like my big thing with Ottawa was just doing like data driven analysis with you know, my own eye tests and an opinion, and early on I kind of struggled because Tyler Dello was writing a ton about Ottawa just because of all the stuff that was happening here. It was a national media story, like every single thing that happened with Ottawa over the last couple of years that was big news. It was just, it wasn't necessarily good news, but it was big news. And you know, I just didn't have an opportunity to write about stuff that I would have loved to have a chance to write about. But it's good right now. I think Haley is absolutely killing it. She's doing such a great job.
For people unfamiliar,
yes, Haley Salvian. Haley Salvian. She's just killing it. She's essentially doing everything on her own because Chris Stevenson and I aren't writing or haven't written since the work stoppage for Ottawa. So she's doing really well. And I think like between Stevenson, myself, and Haley, we all have three kind of different elements that we bring to the table. And I think we do a really good job. Of course, I'm biased in saying that. But, you know, I just hope people give The Athletic a chance who haven't subscribed to it before. It's a great outlet. There's so many different sports platforms there that you can really enjoy. Their baseball coverage, if you're a baseball fan, is top notch. Their NBA coverage of the Raptors and stuff is just unbelievable. And if you're into English Premier football, it's really good. It's well worth it. If you can find the right deal, it's such a good investment.
Well, I think they got like $1.25 a month right now or something on. So yeah, there's always
it's really good. So for like the case of a beer, you can get a subscription for a year, have access to all these articles. A lot of big name writers are there right now. And I don't think there's a better source of sports news right now than The Athletic.
Agree with that. And it's something we reference here a lot because half the stories we end up talking about come from The Athletics. We're always sharing links that are like, by the way, you're going to need a subscription, but worth it, right? So tell me a little bit about, you've got your own podcast right now, you and Haley Salvian. Is that something that you had wanted to do for a while and were just looking for the right opportunity, or, you know, how does that come about?
Well, like when I originally started doing the podcast, I was essentially recording with a buddy of mine named Tim. And then Tim moved overseas to Korea. So I haven't been able to record with him.
That's tough.
We had a good dynamic and a good run. And then eventually I started recording with Graham Creech. Right. And that was fun. Like we had a rapport. Like we knew each other before jumping into the podcast together. We just have mutual friends. And we have a good group of guy friends that gets together relatively regular. And that worked really well for a while. And, you know, we'd rent time at the Carleton University recording studios and before I bought my own gear and everything else. And then, you know, life gets in the way. Graham's got a job full time at 1200. So he's quite busy and he's got a young family as well. And I'm in the same boat. Like I was going through some stuff with my job and life and everything else. And it just, for whatever reason, it wasn't working out. And then it was one of those things that I always wanted to get back into, and then I just needed like the right co-host, and then Haley expressed interest in doing it, and we just kind of just jumped on it, and it's been great.
I've checked out a few episodes out. I'm a Leaf guy, so I can only handle so much Sens talk living in this market, but I have checked out the pod because I like the work that both you guys have been doing. What do you think do you feel like the Sens fan base is underserved? Is that why there's room for a podcast like yours? Is it more of a passion project? What is kind of the motivation for it?
I think Ottawa's like social media market and internet presence is actually pretty good for a small market.
It really
team.
Is.
Oh, like the amount of passion and dedication. Like there's so many blogs. There's so many blogs. So many podcasts. There's so many opportunities for fans just to consume information, and that's awesome. You need that, and I think it makes people better as well. And it's good. Like you can't really underserve this market. There's just so much. There's so many options out there for people, and it's good. That's really good. It's healthy. It's healthy, and it keeps people engaged in the product. And the Ottawa Senators are lucky to have a community like this. And you know, I know people talk about the attendance figures being low and everything else, but I think under the hood, there is a very, very, very passionate group of fans here. And, you know, we don't all think the same, right? We're all not like-minded. There's the broad spectrum of fan. Some people some people will cheer for this team regardless of the circumstances. They're just, they're those fans that, you know, they'll support this team unconditionally. And there's others that want some critical analysis of what this organization's been doing and continues to do. And, you know, there's blogs and podcasts out there that serve those people as well. And, you know, I see on Twitter that people talk about negativity and everything else, but there's just a broad spectrum of opinions out there, and you just kind of have to take, you know, there's something out there for everybody. That's essentially what I'm trying to say.
It really is a passionate market, and like my regular co-host is a big time Sens fan. As I mentioned, I'm a Leafs guy, and we like to do the show with no real dedication to any one sport or subject, other than we're going to make sure we talk a little beer off the top, and we'll be sitting there planning a show, and he'll say to me, like, do you want to talk about them trading for Josh Brown? And I'm like, not really. And
doesn't move the needle much for him.
Right. And he'll say, or I'll say to him, you want to talk about the Leafs re-upping Ilya Mikheyev? And he's like, no, not really. But at some point you have these dedicated fan bases, and it's worth it to touch on these things before moving on to whatever. So you're right. Like it's, I'm amazed all the time, again, because I grow up with that ego of the center of the hockey universe, the Leafs, but when we talk Sens, we get piles of feedback, right? And social media interaction and numbers and stuff. It's amazing how passionate this fan base is, despite how much it gets slagged for the attendance or being a small market or whatever. It is interesting. It's an interesting dynamic. I guess the next thing I wanted to ask you about is sort of your background in analytics, and I'm not going to ask you to dive too deep into it because we do have a lot of listeners who struggle to keep up with some of it. I still struggle to keep up with some of it, but I'll tell you,
after this monster match, I may struggle to keep up with it.
Yeah, fair enough. I got into it first, I think, and you'll tell me if I have these out of order, because you'll know, that shortened season 2012-13 where the Leafs were regularly getting buried and somehow made the playoffs. And even I knew enough, knowing nothing about analytics, to know this is James Reimer and some spare parts that are just on a hot run right now. And then it was either the next year or maybe the same year where Colorado had a very similar...
Minnesota, I think it did as well. Colorado, Minnesota, yeah, Ottawa, yeah, in 2017 as well.
That's the one I was getting to next.
Yeah, so like, I took a lot of flack for talking about that too. It's just, you know, you look at the possession numbers and the you know, you could see it. You could watch it, and you could see that Ottawa was a team that wasn't necessarily that good on the ice, but they were holding it. They're holding well enough together, and then they were scoring at opportunistic times, and they were getting points. They were winning games, and you know, as the season went on, and Ottawa's bubble didn't burst, it just they held on. They made the playoffs, and then they went on this run, and it was exceptionally fun to watch.
Sure.
I enjoyed every second of it, but you knew in the back of your head there was like that nagging suspicion that hey guys, this probably isn't sustainable. And you know,
time of that run, are you already an analytics nerd and you know that this, or is it just an eye test?
For me, it was one of those things where it's, you know, you see the work being done by like Desjardins, who was running I can't even remember what this site was anymore. I can't remember. Terrible. There's been so many. There's been sites.
No problem.
Yeah, it all kind of started on the ice. On the ice is what it was, I think.
Okay.
It all started with like the 5-on-5 numbers, and it's just, there have been so many sites, and I think when I saw like analytics, people started to talk about analytics. Like Eric Tulsky was doing a lot of writing at the time, and you know, obviously he's gone on to great things with the Carolina Hurricanes.
Yep.
He was doing a lot of analysis and work, and you just kind of, at that time, I'm also a huge baseball fan, and you know, if you've been
Moneyball.
Reading. If you've been reading any information on that, you know that, you know, this kind of data and appeal is not going away. It's only going to get stronger.
Yeah.
And I think early on in this process, I kind of realized that if I'm going to write well and do analysis at the same time, it was something that I'd have to make an effort to understand and appreciate. And, you know, I'm not some like data savvy person who's on a level of like a Micah Blake McCurdy from like HockeyViz.com,
sure, yeah,
or like a Manny Perry who ran Corsica. Like I'm not nowhere near at that level, and I'm never going to be, and I don't aspire to be. But I think I have a pretty good grasp of, you know, trends and using numbers to help illustrate points. And I think for me as a writer, I think that's the biggest key, is to use like these data points and data sets and use those numbers to help make a point. And, you know, if I'm going to put my opinion out there and say something, I'm not just going to say it out there for the sake of putting it out there or being different. Like, I'm going to back it up with evidence, quantitative and qualitative evidence to. And I don't know. I hope it enriches my work.
When do you stumble into that? When do you start to go, okay, I'm interested in what someone else is writing here? Or, you know, do you remember roughly when that might happen for you?
Probably 2010, maybe.
Right.
Probably a couple of years after I started. And then, you know, I incorporated it in. But I think it was something that you had to do. And, you know, I'm jealous of the kids coming through right now who have, like, these awesome websites. There's so much better, so much more in depth, and user friendly. A lot of them now, though, you have to use a, you know, they're kind of tucked away behind a paywall. But
sure,
like The Athletic, you should totally invest in them if
you think they're good.
If you believe that they're good, sure. Yeah. So it's been worthwhile. I love being able to support the people who do that work. It's a thankless job, and if I can help out with those people, I will.
When you have to explain the term analytics to somebody or someone who's not familiar and is more still just watching the game casually, what would your like basic explanation be of that kind of overarching term?
I think it's more than anything, it's just risk mitigation, right? You want the numbers to mitigate risk. Are they going to be foolproof? No, nothing's foolproof. You talk about statistical models. I'll give you an example. Sure. Ottawa's 2020 NHL draft has been panned by some analytics people and people who use like model projections to evaluate what Ottawa's done.
And the first round was great, and everything afterwards was suspect.
Yeah. Exactly. A lot of people are saying, you know, these picks, they left a lot of value on the table and they weren't necessarily the best picks for where they were selecting at the time. And others, more traditional scouts, are saying, no, that was a really good draft. Ottawa got like a good defenseman, Jake Sanderson, and they got Tim Stützle, who's going to be a dynamic offensive player, and they got a good, gritty third line type in Ridley Gregg. And that's fine. Like neither side is wrong, but right. I think where a lot of people get hung up is like the data models that are talking about or downplaying Ottawa's draft. They're not saying that Ottawa's picks aren't going to pan out. It's just projection and it's probability and it's using past evidence to help, determine what these prospects might be one, two, three, four, 5 years down the road. And, you know, it's just one of those things where a lot of people will just look at something, they'll see, oh, it's panned, and then they'll immediately dismiss it. But models aren't saying that Tim Stützle isn't going to be a dynamic offensive player or can be. They're just saying that, you know, there might have been some safer, more higher value picks than some of the picks that Ottawa made. And that's, to me, it's just a lot of people get offended really easily.
Yeah, no, and there is almost a fear of the unknown or learning something different. And it's not.
And nobody wants to hear bad things.
No,
too, right? Like, especially when you hear going in this draft, like this draft is going to be the most pivotal moment in franchise history. And for a lot of people to hear that, you know, Ottawa might necessarily whiffed on a couple picks. It's gonna be disappointing for them. They might get upset with it, and you can understand the disdain from that side. It's just sure. You know, you just take everything in and get a complete picture. It's not, yeah, there's nothing wrong with getting every side of an argument and then making your own informed opinion, right?
Right. And so even when we expand to things more like the team instead of a player, I reference that 2013 Leafs team when they never have, they have the puck 30% of the time, they're constantly getting outshot. You can't look at those numbers, even though you're getting wins, and go, this will continue indefinitely. That's a healthy way to play the game. Like, it's just a different set of numbers to look at, right?
And I think the important thing too is that you should be familiar with the data and what the numbers are telling you, because it helps you make more informed decisions on what you're about to do, right? And you look at what Ottawa did after their Stanley Cup run, coming into the fall, like the team wasn't performing at a high level. Their possession numbers were cratered. They're one of the worst possession teams in the league because they've never addressed their blue line since going to the Cup final in 2007. It's one of the worst blue lines over the past 10 years, 15 years. And they failed to address it over the years. And you look at that 2018 fall team, they went out and acquired Matt Duchene. The opportunity cost that they used to get Matt Duchene was huge. And the team wasn't very good. And rather than go out, you know, at the time, I was kind of down on the trade just because there's so many holes on the roster. And I said at the time, like, unless Ottawa has a plan to address the holes on their team, it's a terrible trade. Because they're just top heavy, and that's what it was. And you look at the lack of success that they had over the span when Matt Duchene was here, and it was predictable, and it was a risk that was there. There were red flags there, and they were just ignored. And I think that's the important part with data. It's not some infallible thing. It's open to interpretation, but there's a lot of probabilities, and I think you can hedge your bets and just do things a little bit more smartly. And Ottawa hasn't done that in some cases, and I think it reflects the small market front office and their lack of investment in numbers and analytics.
Let's talk a little bit about the off season that the Senators have had, including the draft. And just today, as we're speaking, they locked up Connor Brown. They also brought in Dadonov, traded for Josh Brown. I'm sure there's other moves I miss. Matt Murray brought in the draft. What has your impression been of the off season that they've had?
Obviously, I think it's a bit of hit and miss. You look at a Connor Brown contract that he just signed today, and I think the Senators got good bang for the buck. You know, like a $3.6 million average annual value on that 3-year deal isn't prohibitively expensive, nor is it prohibitive in the sense that it's not a long term deal.
Right,
it's not some deal where they've locked him into a five or six year term. I think that was fantastic. If you look at the Dadonov signing, here's another player who's had a couple 28-goal seasons. He had a 25-goal season last year. He scored 60, 70 points over the last 3 years. And, yeah, he's played with some really good players in Barkov and Huberdeau.
Right.
But just being able to add him to the mix on the right side is going to be huge. You look at the center's depth on the right side coming into this offseason. I think Connor Brown was the only guy who didn't spend any time in Belleville last season. So adding a guy like Dadonov to the mix was really important for the team. And I think those are like the clear wins. But at the same time, when you're discussing those two wins, I think it's important to realize that like right now there's a really soft market just created by the pandemic, the lack of league revenues. The market's really soft for those middle tier players. And it kind of created this area where, you know, they had to get their money. And I think Ottawa, because of their cap space and the amount of money that they had to spend, were able to go out and get a guy like Dadonov. And, but I think that where I struggle to understand what the organization was doing is more on the back end, getting a guy like Josh Brown, trading assets for an Erik Gudbranson. You know, you look at their blue line, they haven't really gotten significantly better.
You look at those two moves and you go, I think DJ Smith had some words at the end of the season with Pierre Dorion in terms of what he wanted to see. Like those are not exactly the same type of player, but they're DJ Smith players and
prototypical defensive defenseman, high character, will stand up for your teammates. I understand it's a really young team, and there's a lot of value being placed on, you know, having guys like those two players and Austin Watson be able to step up and back the kids up.
Sure.
Will help in certain respects, and there's some value there. It's just, you know, the Senators gave up a lot of assets for guys who aren't going to move the needle very high. And, you know, they spent quite a bit of money this offseason, and that includes Matt Murray, the goaltender.
What did you think of that?
He had a really good first 2 years in the league. And last year, I think he was statistically one of the worst goaltenders in the league, if you're using the goal saved above expected metric.
I think the only redeeming one was the high danger save percentage. He was top 10 or something.
Yeah, and I think he was better shorthanded as well, although I think shorthanded save percentage tends to be a little bit more volatile and less predictable over time. But Matt Murray's he has that age, right? Like, he's only 26. He can grow the young core that Ottawa's put together, and he'll still be young when some of the prospects that they've drafted over the last 2 years, 3 years will come up and be full-time players for the organization. So I can see why they wanted to go get a guy like Matt Murray, and he has that championship pedigree that he had with Pittsburgh. He won two cups. I can totally understand the rationale for going out and getting that guy like that, because Ottawa hasn't ever had a guy like that. And my issue is that he just hasn't been at the same level over the past couple of years that he was at his first two seasons. That's not to say that he can't get back to it. And maybe, like, you know, a change of scenery, a new contract, a new team will reinvigorate him and help get him back to that level. It's just, I think there's enough, there is some statistical evidence that he might not be the same player that he was in the first two seasons. So that's it. That's kind of a concern that I have, especially if you look at the Seattle expansion draft that's coming up next summer.
Right.
Or next offseason, whenever that is. You know, there's going to be an influx of goaltenders on the market because organizations are only allowed to protect one. Season.
Where you wouldn't have had to give up anything. There was a lot of goalies on the market this
season. And, you know, obviously I understand that, you know, free agents aren't necessarily beating down the door to come to Ottawa, given the circumstances that have happened over the past number of years. But I think one of the things that Ottawa can afford people right now is a job. You know, with the goaltending position, there's only, 62 jobs in the league. So if you can offer a guy like a starter's position for a year as a stopgap, I think that could be a really desirable situation, especially if a guy can play himself off this team by the trade deadline. And I think that's all you needed. You could have gone with a 1 year stopgap guy and then looked at the market next summer and then go get a guy that you really like without having to give up a second round pick or, you know, a 4 year term with a high AAV. To bring a guy like Matt Murray in, it's a huge gamble, and it's going to be fun to see how it plays out because I think Matt Murray might be able to get back to that level, but if he doesn't, there's going to be a lot of egg on Pierre Dorion's face.
So before we go any further, I'm going to crack into this Civic Pilsner.
Oh, you're ahead of me.
Well, mine wasn't 8%, so I was able to cut a bit better of a pace, I think. Yeah, I'm looking forward to trying this one as well. What do you think? You referenced the Matt Murray contract. It's backloaded. Almost everything that every team has signed this offseason is backloaded because of the high escrow this season. And probably the next season. And, you know, the pandemic means these players are going to be getting less money. But this is not the first time we've seen the Senators push cash until later. And the joke, I guess, around the market is that maybe Eugene thinks that might be someone else's problem by then if he's going to sell it. But every time you do that, you make the team less attractive to buy, right? Like, the more cash that's going to be hanging around for the next owner. What do you think his end game is? He keeps saying he's not interested in selling, but all his actions suggest he can't do this forever. What do you think is the long-term outlook for this owner?
Well, apparently it's a Stanley Cup of 4 years and a new arena being built in five.
And did we not just come out of the unprecedented success thing we were supposed to be doing too?
So. 5 years. 5 years of unparalleled success are starting next season. I think more than anything, Eugene Melnyk is more of a promoter than he is a good hockey owner. And, you know, no one will ever knock his passion. He loves the hockey. He loves the spotlight. He loves everything that goes with owning a hockey team in Canada. The problem is he's been here for 17 years now? Yeah. 2003? Yeah. So he's been here for 17 years. And
viewed as a hero in 03.
Yeah. Off the top, like, if I had to ask you, what is Eugene Melnyk's legacy? Like, what has he done for this community to put his stamp on things?
Well, in that moment, he kept the team here, but later on, it became under just awful circumstances where you almost, I'm not going to say you wish they were gone, but you're like, this is hard to cheer for. Why did you keep it here? It's an odd, complicated, as an outsider, right?
It's, you know, you look at the organization and it's returned to the tight purse strings days of the previous owners. There was an opportunity to get an arena built at a downtown location. Mm-hmm. and he failed on that front. And he fired some of the, you know, the people who had lasting ties to this organization from its formative days.
Right.
Guys like Cyril Leader, Cyril Leader, who helped get Eugene Melnyk a liver and made the appeal to the public to get him a liver. And he was fired from his job because he wanted to get a guy from Toronto to help build LeBreton. And within a year, that guy from Toronto was fired.
Yeah.
And to me, the legacy of the owner is that he's hired a bunch of people who think that they can help change this stubborn owner who has all the power. And the truth is, you can't change Eugene Melnyk. You're never going to change Eugene Melnyk. And the people who try,
when he says he doesn't want to sell,
yeah. He says a lot of things that I just don't believe. Like, and that's not a knock on him. It's just he's a shameless promoter, a self-promoter, and he's got a lot of bravado, and he makes a lot of promises. And, you know, over time, it's like the boy who cries wolf. You just stop believing in his promises. And, you know, I think there's a lot of fatigue in this market for what he says and what he brings to the table. And you know, I think people will stomach him because right now you don't have a choice. And until he sells, there have been so many stories over the years saying, you know, like, oh, I think this is the year. I don't think he can hold on to this hockey team past this year. And then 5 years later, you hear the same stories come up. And it's just one of those things that I don't think a lot of fans who want to see him gone are pinning their hopes to those things anymore. They've gone through it. They're tolerating him because they have no choice. And, you know, he's got his ardent group of fans who keep buying season tickets and will support the team. You know, Jack Maxwell. they'll support him unconditionally, and that's fine. That's not to knock fans who don't care about the off the ice stuff and the distractions and you know the news items that other people care about. And you know, it's just one of those things where it's just going to have to play out. And I just think a lot of fans just don't really invest too heavily in what he has to say right now.
Well, so let's say this all pans out beautifully. Brännström is going to be a stud, and Stützle, he's NHL ready right now. And like within 2 years, obviously they're not going to be quite ready to win a cup, but they're back contending for a playoff spot. Will Sens fans come back and fill the building despite the Melnyk out, all that stuff, to support the team? Or is this going to be doomed until he's gone?
Winning is a bit of a cure-all, right?
Sure.
If you have the opportunity to put a more competitive product on the ice, I think you're going to draw fans back. I don't think, you know, you look at other markets around the league and it's no different. When teams are on the downswing, it's easier to get tickets. They're not selling out buildings. I don't think Ottawa is any different in that respect. And, you know, fans in this community still want to watch hockey. And, you know, earlier in the show, we talked about the passion that this fan base has. And even though ticket sales might be down, like there's still a really tightly knit community online that really loves and supports this organization. They want to see them ultimately do well, and they want to see them win a Stanley Cup down the road. I don't think that just because they might not like the owner, I don't think that changes.
How much does it stay in your head, do you think, that we're just 3 years away from having to pay Stützle or whatever, so why get attached to him? Like, do you think...
I think we get tied up on Twitter
that's the average fan, and it's just not. Like, we spend all this time talking about the business side and all this. I do think there are a much larger crowd that's just like, hey, if the team's good, I'm going to go.
Yep. I just think it's like not expecting the Senators to be able to sign those guys down the road is pretty cynical. It's just like... you know, it's almost like a blessing in disguise. Like, I think one of the funny things about Ottawa letting all the guys go that they did over the past number of years, whether it's Kyle Turris, Eric Karlsson, Mark Stone, Matt Duchene, like, they let a number of players go who were approaching 30 and would be over the age of 30 on bad contracts. And
hindsight being what it is, you don't want any of those guys.
What you know about the NHL, it's a young man's league, and I think it's a market if in it. It could be the... Because of the Senators' money situation, they might have stumbled onto the market inefficiency that you can take advantage of, where a guy approaches 30, wants a max deal, and you're like, no, we're going to trade you. We're going to trade you. Sorry. Yeah. And, you know, when the Senators rebuilt, I think it was essentially designed to save the organization money. But they won't come up and say that. They'll say it was a hockey-related decision. They made the decision to go young. But inevitably, it comes with the benefits of not being able to spend a lot of money on their hockey club, right?
Well, all those guys, like, that you referenced, Mark Stone would be the only one we were like, wish we'd have kept that guy. Like, in hindsight, maybe it's too soon to say on Pageau, but with Turris, but with Duchesne, with Carlson, you're like,
yeah. And look around the league, right? Even with Stanley Cup winners, you look at what has happened with the Los Angeles Kings. Like, they got old. You look at the Chicago Blackhawks, who just said that they're going to undergo a rebuild. They just sent a letter out to their fans.
I think they're the only ones who didn't know they've been rebuilding for a couple of years.
Yeah, it's just like... People get, you know, when your best players get over the age of 30, I think the Pittsburgh Penguins might be the exception here where they've had success with Crosby and Malkin over the age of 30. But when your best players are over the age of 30, that's kind of your window. You have a very small window to work with unless they're like the elite of the elite. And when players like that enter their decline, maybe it's not as severe as, you know, like a Kyle Turris or a Matthew Shane or whomever. But walking away from the guys that the Senators did, it was probably the best timing. And, you know, and you can't begrudge them for that. And the Senators have added a lot of young prospects to their system and high draft picks. And it's going to be fun to see how it plays out. And if everything breaks, there's no reason why this organization can't be competitive at the same time. But the one concern that I have is that Pierre Dorion's track record for adding players and making hockey-related decisions when the team is trying to be competitive, it's not very good.
Right.
At least it's nowhere near the level that it was when he was like tearing down the roster and trading players for prospects and picks, which is, you know, not to begrudge the job that he did, but, you know, like anyone could sell assets to, you know, you're just essentially selling to the highest bidder.
Yeah.
It's one of the easiest jobs that you can do as a general manager. So I think all the pressure is squarely on him. I think all the pressure is on the ownership to put their money where their mouth is. You know, we talked earlier about, you know, backloaded contracts that they've been signing. And I think, you know, you get to the like the 2022-23 season when guys like Matt Murray and Dadonov are making way more money. And that's could conceivably that should be the time when the team's a lot better, right?
Right.
So if the team, you just wonder if those backloaded deals are going to affect what the team is going to be able to spend to make the team around them better. And that's kind of like the only concern I have is just this organization has to put its money where its mouth is, step up and sign the guys that they have to, augment the core that they built and put in place. And they got to be able to do that because that's what they've been promising fans. And if they can't.
It just looks, right? It's inescapable to get around the, it looks like, hey, no money down, pay later. And you're like, is there going to be money there later? Or is that going to be from someone else? Or, you know, there's just a lot of those deals, and I don't know what that looks like. And granted, I give the Senators an extra hard time because of my own fandom. But, you know, just being reasonable, you go, there's a lot of money to be paid in 2022 or whatever it is, and I don't know that he's got it. So.
For sure. But at the same time, you know, you talk about the young RFAs that Ottawa will have in like 2 or 3 years, and, you know, unless players like Brady Tkachuk or like a Tim Stützle ask for a trade in like 3 years, Ottawa has all the contract leverage. You know, those players are under team control until they hit UFA or become unrestricted free agents, sorry. And the organization has leverage.
We've seen what RFAs ask for now.
Yeah, but like, and you know, that's the funny wrinkle, right? With the new NHL.
Maybe that's just us.
Salary.
Here's 10 million. Take it. It's fine.
Well, even like Connor McDavid, right? Like, if you're a good young player coming off his entry level contract, you're going to get paid, and you're going to get paid significantly more than 15-20 years ago. Where like an organization would hold on to your rights until the age of 31, like you just didn't have as much leverage, and like you can't avoid. You can't avoid having to pay these young guys who come through the system. And you know, more than ever, like young guys are making money faster than ever. And it's going to be incumbent on the organization to put the money where their mouth is and pay these guys when they're up for new contracts.
So we just heard you crack the pistachio stout over there. It's 10%. I'm going to be intrigued to hear what your first impressions on that are. While you're taking your first pull on that, we had Steve Warren in not long after the Sen signed Shabbat. And Colin White, and I can't remember in which order those happened, but it was after the second one, and I said to him, is this enough yet? Are you sold? He goes, I need one more. You're going to have to show me one more long-term, you know, and you hope it's Tkachuk, but I think Brady's got one more season before he's an RFA, is that correct?
Yep, they could start negotiating with him now.
What do you expect that number to look like?
It's a good question. I think if you even look at his brother's contract situation with Calgary, like his brother only signed a short-term deal. I believe it was two years.
Yeah, I think that's right.
I don't anticipate that being different. I think the Kachucks are kind of savvy in the sense that, you know, they'll sign shorter term deals, get closer to unrestricted free agency, and then try and cash in on unrestricted free agency.
Well, and so unique in the league now, right? With the way those guys play the game. That's not a lot of that out there.
Well, and there's, you know, like I keep on my podcast with Haley, like all we talk about in any of the episodes is like how nice is it going to be to have a guy like Brady Tkachuk be that much closer to the playoffs? And what is he going to be like in the postseason? Like he's just one of those players who gets under the skin of the opponent. And Ottawa could have used a guy like that back in like 2006, 2002, like during the team's heyday. Like having a guy like Tkachuk would have meant like a world. It would have been like adding Gary Roberts, the move that got John Mockler fired. Like it's that kind of like net front presence.
Yes. Yeah.
The grit and agitation. That's what you, those are the players who make their bank in the postseason. And Brady's a great player. And you hope he stays in Ottawa long term. But again, the organization is going to have to find a way to keep him in the fold past his like first couple of unrestricted free agent years.
So I'm going to hold you there. What does, even if it's short term, give me a number, give me an AAV to keep that guy in Ottawa, even just coming through the RFA years?
I'm going to say it's over 7. I'll say 7 to 8 because I think his brother's around the same number, and I wouldn't be surprised if they use like a similar style contract to get it done. Yeah, his brother's making $7 million right now, and he signed his 3-year deal, I believe. Yeah,
right,
3-year deal. But yeah, I would expect something similar. And you know, you look at what Brady's had to go through since being here. You know, he was Mark Stone's roommate, and if you're looking at contract negotiations, like. And everything else that's gone on here, like Brady Tkachuk knows exactly what happened with the Mark Stone contract and the negotiations there. And even Keith Tkachuk was on a TSN panel before the game, preaching the importance about keeping a player like Mark Stone in the fold.
Right.
And, you know, it's, you wonder whether events like that will, you know, weigh on Tkachuk's decision to stay here or, you know, how much of a role that'll play on things. And, you know, Tkachuk's an American guy, and hopefully he doesn't want to return to the States anytime soon to play hockey. But who knows? Who knows? It's just going to be incumbent on the organization to find a way to keep this guy in the fold for the long term, at least until the age of 30 when they tear this down again.
So what's the first impression on the pistachio stout, the 10%?
It's good. It tastes, you can definitely get the pistachio flavor like right off the hop.
Good.
And then it kind of goes vanilla-y, and then it hits you with the Imperial Stout flavor at the very end. It's like the Imperial Stout finish. So it's a pretty strong finish, but everything leading up to it is really sweet.
I like the ones that if you're going to call it a pistachio stout, you better hit me with that, right? Like whatever you're putting in that title, I want to feel it. I don't want like a faint hint of this or that. So you're saying it's going to deliver that when I get to that one down the road here.
Yeah, you will definitely notice it right off the hop.
And at 10%, are you tasting that right away, that it's trouble right away?
Yeah, it's just that, you know, that you get those Imperial Stouts that are like really, really, really sweet, kind of strong finish, and that's exactly what you're getting. Like there's it's marketed well.
Perfect. I'll be looking forward to checking that one out. What does the future hold in terms of the arena? Do you think that's dead? Obviously, the deal that was initially on the table is dead. And can the team survive or thrive again without getting downtown?
Well, I think they've had success being in Canada before, and there's nothing to say that they can't have success being in Canada for the foreseeable future. But I think, like, you know, if you want to create a product that engages the entire community and gives everyone in the city like great access to an arena and an enjoyable experience, I think you have to have it downtown. I don't think you can replicate the game day feel that you could have walking up to a rink and being able to go to a restaurant or a pub.
That's right.
With your buddies, or, you know, going there after a game. And I think that's where the CTC is ultimately falling short. You know,
I'll go out to the CTC when the Leafs are in town, but if they're downtown, I'll go when the Pens are in town or whatever, right? Like,
And I think if you look at the shortcomings of the CTC, like everybody complains about parking and egress and getting out of the rink in a timely fashion. But I mean, I think the greatest failure of that building was to put, you know, high tech commercial area all around it and an auto park and a police station. Like it's probably the most underserved arena in the league, in the sense that there's nothing to do around it that's within walking distance. And it creates less of an experience on game days.
We had a couple of years ago, my cousin and I go out to a game in it's Leafs are in town, and we want to go to what's the name of Chris Neal's bar out there? Central Beer House. Yeah, it's like across the highway. You can't just walk, or at least we can't. Like, we don't know where we're going, or if you... So we have to call an Uber at the end of the game, and we're standing outside in the freezing cold with the girls, and eventually we find one, and it cost him, I think, $77 to take an Uber across the highway to the Central Beer, just because of the surcharges, or whatever they call it, surge pricing or whatever. And but there's one place to go, and it's a mess, man.
Yeah, and it's just a great shortcoming. And, you know, it's fun. Like, you go to other barns around the league if you've, I don't know if you have the opportunity to, but, like, you go to a Columbus, and, like, they have, like, a little bar district, like, right outside the arena. And same deal with Pittsburgh. Like, you were then walking distance to a number of bars. And
Montreal's the same way. Toronto's, like, obviously like that. I spent a fair bit of being right downtown. And even Toronto, for the suburb people, you're off the GO train from anywhere in the GTA, and it's a 3-minute walk to the arena. There's no replacing that, right? Like, and even here, they built the light rail with stops, assuming they didn't put stops in on that light rail, assuming it was going to stay field, right?
No, and imagine you could put the light rail right into the bowels of an arena, so you're never outside when you get off the sub. You know, like, you could literally just walk out and be at the rink, and having that kind of experience, it'd be like Montreal, like going to Olympic Stadium. You know, like, if you don't have to be outside in the elements of minus 30. And I think that's, like, part of the problem too, right? Like, everybody talks about a downtown arena on game day and having, like, this walk-up experience, but it's also going to be, like, extremely cold for the duration of the season. So, yes. Like, you kind of need that kind of, like, security blanket where you can take a train to the game, be underground and come up, and you're never in the elements.
The Ottawa winter.
You know, yeah, exactly. and then you get to the spring when it's playoff time, and it's going to be an awesome atmosphere. You're going to be close to Elgin Street. You're going to be close to Westboro, Hindenburg. And there's going to be so many different opportunities just to have a cool game day experience. And it's by the water. It should be scenic. There should be things to do. And it would just bring a new dynamic to this city. And I think, like, Ottawa always gets slagged for being, like, not necessarily a fun town. And I think it would... You know, just having an arena in that area would just do so much to change that perception of Ottawa as a fun city to be in, because I think Ottawa is a great city to be in. It's a great city to live in. There's a lot of fun that can be had here. It's just, it's one of those knocks that people seem to put on Ottawa.
Well, because there is a thing, like, if you go out for a game or you go out there to a concert and you've had a few before and then maybe during, and by the time you get a bus or a cab back, maybe your buzz is half worn off and you're just, like, not even willing to go find the stuff that would eliminate the idea that it's a boring town. There are nice pubs and bars and stuff down, but you're just like, oh, it took me 70 minutes to get back here. Screw it. Right. Like,
yeah, exactly.
It's, like, frustrating.
Who wants to, like, I don't know. Anytime I leave the rink, the best thing, I honestly think the best thing you can do after a game is, if you're in no rush to get out of there, just have a beer at one of the places inside, wait half an hour as you're drinking your beer, and then go back out to your car. And by the time you get to your car and out, most of the traffic will have dissipated. And that's, rather than just sit in your car, actually, if you want to sit in your car and listen to TSN 1200, that's not a terrible alternative. Yeah. But
I took a friend who was visiting from Australia a couple years ago. Had never been to an NHL game, obviously. I said, well, let's do that. So I think it was Family Day weekend or something. There was a holiday Sunday game or whatever in the afternoon. So we buy tickets at the absolute last second online. No idea where they are. Can't find the section. It was like AA row 2. It turns out these tickets that we got absolute last second are like second row behind the net in the, I think it was called the Bell Club. And yeah, well, we had no idea till we got there. And she actually looks at me, she's like, are you trying to big time me? And show me. I was like, I'm more in awe than you are. Like, I've never sat this close before. And so they have, like, a bar back underneath. And so I asked during the second intermission, like, where are we? Why do we have access to this bar that, you know, I don't know where we are. She's, oh, no, someone who owns them probably put them on the secondary market. by the way, come back down here afterwards. They always interview a player for the radio in this area, and this is the only bar that stays open on this level or whatever. I'm like, sweet. So we're down there, and we have a beer and a couple free desserts and watch this interview. And by the time we head out and call an Uber, yeah, you just cruise right out on the ramp. Everybody's gone.
It's just an extra half an hour that you'd be sitting in the parking lot waiting for your car to warm up. Right. So
might as well have a pint and a couple of Nymo bars.
There you go. There you go.
Tell me what you thought as, I don't know, a guy who I would expect to maybe be a little extra harsh if he could be. On the Leafs offseason, what have you thought about what they've done to kind of rebuild their bottom six and then add some pieces to the defense? What have you thought of what Kyle's done down there?
Oh, getting rid of Cody Cease, who was huge.
Yeah. Shipped him right into Pittsburgh.
No, like, everybody knows what the issue was in Toronto, right? Mm-hmm. And I'll even draw a parallel with Ottawa's draft from this year. You draft a lot of high-end skilled forwards. They're excellent forwards. No one will argue that the Leafs didn't have a strong forward contingent. But the problem is their back end. Right, and, you know, you look at what Ottawa did with their draft this year. A lot of people knocked the Sanderson pick because there are better offensive talents available on the board. But at the same time, I think there has to be a recognition that there is some value to be had by building out your defense. And, you know, in adding a Jake Sanderson, hopefully Ottawa is going to be at the point where their blue line is going to be a strength. And after watching this organization for the past 15 years struggle to move the puck and transition it well from defense to offense, like, having a good blue line is going to be awesome. And if it came at the price of adding an offensive player, then that's just something that we're going to have to live with down the road. And I think in Toronto, they're trying to retool that blue line on the fly without spending a ton of money. I think adding like TJ Brody is going to help. I think anytime you can upgrade Cody Ceci with TJ Brody, even if Brody isn't the player that he was 2-3 years ago in Calgary, it's going to be a welcomed addition to the team. And you know, you look at what teams like Tampa have done, where they've targeted players who are good possession guys, but who also play with a bit of an edge and have a bit of grit to them. And Toronto added some grit. I don't think they added players that necessarily fit what the Tampa model did, but
no.
They're trying to change their elements a little bit. It's cool to see a guy like Joe Thornton change things up, although I don't know why he would want to change things up so far into his NHL career when he seemed pretty comfortable in San Jose.
Yeah.
But like, he's a likable player. Gonna have to not like him next season. But there's a couple cool stories with Toronto. And does it make them better? I think their blue line got significantly better without CeCe. And they should theoretically be better and more competitive. Like, they're a competitive team to begin with, but you know, changing up that blue line dynamic is something that's going to be awesome.
Well, do you think, like, when I look at them, and I we don't know what the regular season is going to look like yet, and are we doing a Canadian division, are we whatever? I could see them, if we played a normal season, being a point or two worse in the regular season than maybe they would have been, but maybe being more ready for the playoffs. And they didn't add a ton of, like you said, like a Blake Coleman or a Barkley Goodrow. But you're far more comfortable sending Joe Thornton out for a defensive zone faceoff than a Freddie Gauthier. Or, you know, Wayne Simmonds is going to do his thing. Or, you know, just some of those pieces that they've brought in maybe make them better playoff teams, even if they don't necessarily make them a 110-point regular season team.
No, and I think what they're doing kind of speaks to how well Dubas has kind of run things. Like, you're getting veterans who are taking league minimum to come there and try and win, right? And I think, like, under the salary cap structure, I think that's one of the better things that you could ask for, is, like, good players want to play there for cheap. And whether it pans out, who knows? But I think, like, it all depends on Freddie Anderson, right? Like, if he really needs to bounce back and then prove he can be a legitimate goaltender who can win them a ton of games, because he's a guy who's had a ton of success during the regular season, but in the postseason that hasn't necessarily been the story. And, you know, the goaltending position is a volatile one and everything else, so you're kind of hoping that he has a bounce back here.
So last thing for you then, as we have gone through the draft and most of free agency is done, there are some names who seem to have stood around too long in the game of musical chairs, but we'll see how that shakes out. Who did maybe the best in this offseason, or something that you looked at and went, hey, that's a really good move for those guys?
Oh, good question. Geez, off the top of my head.
Are you as high on what Montreal's done as what a lot of people are?
I'm not sure. Like Max Domi, I'm not a huge fan of, just stylistically, in you know, I hated his dad, so that just works against him immediately. Like Martin Bergevin's like one of those weird GMs where he doesn't do a ton of stuff really well, but he doesn't, you know, like when he makes when he makes a good move, you're like, oh, that's a really good move. Like getting like Jeff Petrie like a couple years ago, you're like, damn, like.
Well, and even when it looked like he was going to get crushed in the Subban deal, he didn't.
Right? Yeah. Like even when it looked like
he got crushed in the Galchenyuk deal, he didn't.
Yeah, like, and he just kind of survives, right? Like, he's just like, at any point, like, if Montreal came out tomorrow and you're like, yeah, Mark Bergevin got fired, you'd be like, oh, I could totally understand that.
I guess but
but he just keeps making these shrewd moves every once in a while to, like, save his job. And I don't know. They're one of those teams that has like a deep farm system like Ottawa's, but they don't have that high end talent that a lot of teams, you know, with strong farm systems have.
Right.
They're a weird team, man. Montreal's a super weird team.
No, I agree. I don't know what they're exactly doing there. There's a possibility that Josh Anderson deal looks great. There's a better possibility in my mind that it looks terrible. I get it. When he comes in and puts a gun to your head and says 1 year or 7 years, I get it. You're not going to walk him to UFA. But if this doesn't pan out, man.
But, like, again, their team has a bunch of forwards that you wouldn't necessarily want to build a team around. Like Josh Anderson, Jonathan Drouin, Thomas Tatar, Tyler Toffoli.
There's no centerpieces.
No, it's like, you know, like those Buffalo teams from like yesteryear where they had like deep, decent players, but like no significant superstars. Like Brendan Gallagher is a fantastic player, right?
Yeah.
But kind of similar in the vein of like Brady Tkachuk, where he goes to the net, gets a lot of tips, deflections, everything else. Like he's that under the skin guy that you'd love to have on your team. But he's a fun player to have, but they just seem like a collection of like good players, but not great ones.
No, and I agree with that.
You just kind of wonder how it's all going to pan out in the end. And you can say the same about their farm system. And, you know, Carey Price isn't getting any younger. He's 30, I think he's 33.
Yep.
And, you know, he's got like 5 or 6 more years on his contract. And there's a lot of money invested in him and Shea Weber in terms of cap hit. And I just don't know. They seem like one of those teams that's like kind of, they're on the bubble for being like good, but not good enough. But at the same time, they're not bad enough to like get one of the high end picks they probably need to like put their team over the top.
Assume, I know I said that'd be the last one, but I lied. Assume we're going to do an all Canadian division. Which 4 teams are getting in and which 3 are missing?
That seems pretty straightforward, I think. Depending on what Winnipeg does for the rest of
the Twitter and there's so many rumors about Winnipeking.
But yeah,
it wasn't that straightforward.
I would say Toronto, Vancouver, Calgary, and Edmonton should advance. Mind you, Edmonton's one of those weird teams that could take a fall back too, and Montreal could sneak in. I would say for sure Vancouver, Calgary, and Toronto should be fine, and then it's a toss-up between Edmonton, Winnipeg, and Montreal for the last spot, which
I've got kind of
a cop-out, but...
I got Winnipeg bumping Vancouver out.
Oh, yeah?
And the rest, I agree with you. Just because I just
don't think Winnipeg's blue line's strong enough.
No, it's not. But I don't really like Vancouver's anymore, either.
No, although that's true, too. But I think,
I like Hellebuck. And
he's fantastic.
Yeah. Tell people where they can find your work and tell them a little more about the podcast as it rolls on. I don't even think I hit people with the title of it, so why don't we go ahead and
you can find the Common Sense Podcast with Haley Salvian on any major streaming platform. You can find my work at thesixthsense.com. You can find me on Twitter at sixthsense. And you can find some of my stuff at The Athletic as well. Hopefully I'll be back there once the pandemic subsides and hockey resumes as normal. But you can find me in those places. And Matt, I really enjoyed being on. This was a lot of fun. Thank you.
This was great. I really enjoyed this too. And normally we provide the beers. And you had to do your own thing here this time. So when the pandemic's over, we'll get you in studio if you're down for that. And we owe you a couple beers and we'll do that.
I will bring the beers.
Right on.
I promise you I'll bring the beers.
Perfect. That is Graham Nichols, The Sixth Sense, on Twitter. As he said, we'll share the links that he's mentioned here and certainly the podcast. Highly recommend that one, especially for you Sens fans out there. But even if you're not, well worth a listen to keep an ear down on what's happening here in the Ottawa market. We are on Twitter and Instagram at TallCanAudio, Facebook.com/TallCanAudio. Make sure you subscribe wherever you're listening to this one, and we'll catch these all later on.
What you just said is one of the most insanely idiotic things I have ever heard. At no point in your rambling, incoherent response were you even close to anything that could be considered a rational thought. Everyone in this room is now dumber for having listened to it. I award you no points, and may God have mercy on your soul.
Thanks for listening. You can get more TCA at TallCanAudio.com or by searching TallCanAudio on your favorite podcast app.